It is time for bringing in David Terachuk with the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning. We are always fantastically happy to have him with us as we take a look at the media and its coverage of events around the world and around the globe. David has his own website, which is themediabeat.us. David's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And if it's another Friday, it's another Friday talking about really the unpredictable life of Vladimir Putin and how it's affecting the rest of the world. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. It's good to be reporting in from the media capital of the world, New York City, once again, joining the always insightful Marshall Miles. Yes, the wonderful mind of Vladimir Putin and what he's committed the world to. We're called in this slot the Media Beat.
Yes. So,
while the Putin's war in Ukraine grinds on, with more cities being attacked now on day 23, and while it brings misery, death, and destruction to all manner of people, be they Ukrainians or Russians, army or civilians, I want to pay this week special attention in, to the media workers of this war.
Yeah.
It may be... In fact, it probably is invidious to concentrate on media people, since deaths are now numbered in the thousands in this war, all across all manner of roles, as I say, in life, military or non-military. But I still want to point out that some remarkable actions have been taken by journalists, and there have been some bad losses suffered by the profession, too. In Putin's own Russia, on state TV, editor Marina Ovsyannikova dramatically held up a protest poster this week. Did you all see it? Saying, don't believe the lies. That was during a live broadcast, and she was yelling, no war, stop the war, behind the news anchor delivering the scripted part of the program. Until, of course, the show's director quickly cut away to another report. But Marina made her impact. She was arrested and appeared in court. But interestingly, so far at least, hasn't been treated with the full force of Putin's newest authoritarian measures against journalists. She was fined just under $300, say, but was not, not yet, as I say, sentenced to 15 years in jail, which is what offending against the Kremlin's new rules can now bring reporters, including for the offense of just using the word war about what Russia is doing in Ukraine. Those new restrictions are forcing many independent and the few remaining independent. Foreign press entities in Russia and some foreign press do, including the BBC, to have to suspend their work and do kind of workarounds to get their coverage of Russia and not have their people expelled or, still worse, jailed. There's also been, just to step away from media a little bit, there's been an extraordinary development, too, of more than 14,000 Russians being detained for staging protests, not just Marina on TV. That's a full count since the war started, according to the monitoring group OVD Info. Some of them doubtless are journalists, but the sheer mass of ordinary people involved here is striking. They're being prepared to risk so much in taking part in public disapproval of Russia. Well, I was going to say Russia's war. I mean, of course, Vladimir Putin's war. It's becoming clear that the Russian people, many of them, maybe a lot of them, it's very hard to judge, I feel offended at not having been consulted in this war. But, of course, the most obvious thing to say, of course, is that in Ukraine, a much heavier price is being paid, and outrageously to all civilized opinion, it's being paid by non-combatants, still unknown number, maybe as many as 1,200 civilians were taking shelter, infamously so, in Mariupol's drama theater, only to have it bombed by the Russians in an apparent airstrike. More is being discovered about this pretty obvious-looking war crime posted all over the world now. The satellite images of that theater with the word children, deti in Russian, in the Cyrillic alphabet, painted on the ground, each side of that theater. While strikingly some survivors have been found amidst that rubble, I'm afraid that the actual casualty and death toll is still unknown. President Zelensky has said it's still unknown so far how many people died in that theater. Inevitably, they will include women and children.
You know, when you talk about the media coverage, we should bring up the media deaths that have taken place in the past week.
Indeed. The ultimate price is being paid by journalists. Sasha Koshinova, the local stringer for Fox News, who was just 24, and the network's veteran cameraman, Pierre Zakrevsky, died when Russian fire hit their car. The correspondent with them, Benjamin Hall, was injured. He was medevaced out of harm's way, out of the country entirely, in fact. Targeting a journalist, is in itself a war crime. And for what it's worth, they're always going to be at risk in the field. Cameraman Zakrevsky, who's in his 50s, seems to be in some ways emblematic of our modern globalized generations, if you like, a fine representative of our notions of free movement for people and ideas. He had a French mother and a Polish father. He was an Irish citizen, though. He was born in Dublin, in fact, the European capital. It's fast becoming my own second home, as you know. Zakrevsky was, in a way, the complete antithesis of Vladimir Putin, who looks like a throwback to the 19th and 20th centuries with his fantastical creation of a fortress Russia, isolated from the rest of the world. Isolated by a count, you'll remember, of 141 countries to four at the United Nations, just in case there's any doubt about that Russian isolation. And those Fox News deaths came after that of an American, Brent Renault, who used to make documentaries with his brother Craig. The Renault brothers won a Peabody Award for their portrait of a disadvantaged high school in Chicago. Brent was on assignment for Time magazine's video arm when he was shot. There was a little confusion to begin with because he was carrying a New York Times press pass, but that was because of some work he'd done freelancing for the Times some years ago. If this is a sort of matter of practicality and good sense, if you've got a very recognizable media name on your, you know, title on your press pass, it really makes good sense when you're in a foreign country to use the most famous sounding name and your credentials. It can just make a little bit of difference and make you more likely to be accepted. But of course, as I say, the risks are always terrible when shooting starts out. The first known death of a journalist was very early in the war. Yevgeny Skoum, a cameraman for a Ukrainian TV channel. More broadly, the International Reporters Without Borders support group has confirmed today that the casualty rate is now 4 dead media workers and 7 seriously wounded, and we'll inevitably see that number climb. The organization has opened up a new media center in Lviv in western Ukraine, which only today has been attacked for the first time. At least the airplane repair facility very nearby, right on the outskirts of Lviv, was attacked. And in Lviv, too, the Reporters Without Borders have just taken delivery of first consignment of bulletproof vests for journalists. They've been provided by the German Network for Reporting on Eastern Europe, known as NOST, and by the Swedish press group Bonnier. So, yeah, the war goes on, grinds on, as I say, and you know, we only know about it because journalists are prepared to take the risk. And inevitably, of course, in taking that risk, some of them lose their lives, and some, you know, get injured. Sometimes, you know, sometimes these war injuries will blight the careers of those people who, you know, whose sole purpose is to bring the information to us, the consuming public.
You know, one thing I noticed, and I went back and I did a little investigative look at war deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan, and one thing that points out in this case in the war in Ukraine is at least three of the incidences were not misfires or not accidents, but actually shooting at the press.
Which is there was very little doubt. I mean, in the case of the Fox News car full of reporters, and there's no doubt, that they were deliberately targeted. They were moving in two different directions. I mean, they turned around when they saw what was happening, and they were pursued. And, you know, they'd taken good care to advertise themselves as press, but it made no difference to whichever Russian unit was firing at them.
I can go back. One of my friends, Joe Corcoran, was a correspondent in Iraq, and he was leaving Iraq. He was in a taxi heading to the airport, and by accident, and it was by accident, he got involved in a crossfire between American soldiers and some assailants, and the taxi got shot up. Now, he survived. He survived, shaken, but survived. So I just can't, and when I spoke to him after it, it gave me a whole new depth of meaning to the people that cover these war scenes. Mark Niethammer lives in our area. He passed away recently. He was a cameraman for ABC, and he took a couple of these war assignments where they're paid very good money, but it's a very dangerous job, and the stories that he told match these. And David, I just, you know, I give all the credit in the world to these reporters who want to go out there and simply bring the fact of what's going on.
I sometimes think it's amazing that so many of us do survive, I have to say. My own narrow squeaks can still bring me out in a bit of a cold sweat if I want to relive them, but I'd rather not. It's... Well, I mean, again, I don't want to overplay it. I mean, it can be a little invidious. I mean, thousands of people now. I mean, 7,000 Russians have been sent to their death in this war. Conscripts, most of them. Something like 3,000, maybe, Ukrainians also paid the ultimate price. No number yet for injuries. And at the same time, how many of those are civilians? Well, the United Nations has tried to estimate a figure, but it's very low. It's suspiciously low. They're saying around 700 Ukrainian civilians have been killed. But, you know, if the Mariupol theater is anything in itself to judge by, there must be many, many more than that. There were possibly up to 1,200 people, civilians, women and children mostly, in the theater, using it as a bomb shelter. Just who knows how many people were killed there? But certainly, you know, the notion that Ukrainian civilians being killed is numbered only in the hundreds now is probably way over optimistic as a way of calculation.
You know, I had the same feeling looking at some of these news reports. Somebody getting killed in war is somebody getting killed. If it's a civilian, it's ultra tragic because they're not involved in the fighting. But I was looking at the age of the Ukrainian soldiers and the Russian soldiers, the videos of them. They're kids. Yeah, I'm sorry. Most of them are in their 20s. And yes, the Russians have lost three very high-ranking military officials through their own stupidity of talking on cell phones and being able to be located. But these are generations of families that will never come to fruition because of one man's war. It really is it is just an unbelievably sad thing.
Yeah, every war is fought by young men mostly. Nowadays, more women, of course, but young for sure, the vast majority. Go right back to the First World War, and you look at the headstones of graves that, carpet so much of Western Europe, and Eastern Europe, too, of course, from World War II. And you'll see the ages, tragically low numbers, 17, 18, 19 years old. That is, the traditional word in World War I was cannon fodder. It is our youngsters that we send to fight on our behalf, and it's they who carry the burden, the fatal burden of war.
Now, I'm going to ask you a question as someone who's been involved in scenes of war and gunfire, and I look at what's going on now, and I don't see an early end to this, and I don't see a good end to this. Vladimir Putin is just—he has committed so much of himself into this invasion into Ukraine. I really fear that it could expand, and all it takes is one small incident where an American military person gets killed, or a Russian military person gets killed by an American, and this thing completely goes haywire.
Yeah, the overall picture is, as I say, I keep using the word grind. That's what it is on the ground. That's what's happening. The swift operation that it would appear Putin was hoping for has not taken place. There's something of a stall going on, even while, as I said earlier, the attacks on cities is being cranked up, and Lviv has been attacked for the first time, at least the outskirts of Lviv has been attacked for the first time. So there's a whole range of cities that are now coming under siege of a kind, some very definitely a complete siege, like Mariupol. What's developing, however much pounding may go on from the Russians with artillery and airstrikes and missiles, the Russians are in a kind of stalled state, largely because of the extraordinary defense that the Ukrainians have been able to put up, agile and mobile and very, very effective. It doesn't mean, of course, that they can win, militarily speaking, that is, against such a massive force. But they can certainly make it a dogged, dismal business. And given that, you're right. When there's a military stall in place and no great advantage being achieved by the major force involved, then frustration sets in at the leadership, and these terrible, almost random, not quite random, of course, because they have intentions in mind, but scattershot cluster bombs, for instance, those sort of weapons will get used more. Attacks meant quite deliberately to collapse public morale, the pounding of cities in residential areas and as we've seen, even hospitals and schools, maternity hospital or children's hospital in the east. We will see patients running thin. And in that sort of tinderbox atmosphere, as you say, an incident that ends up targeting someone that so much of policymakers' concern at the moment being to avoid a direct confrontation between the major powers involved here, Russia directly involved, America on the other side definitely in shadow form involved, trying to influence the situation, but not turn it into a direct confrontation. That is what everybody from the earliest days of the Cold War has been anxious to avoid. But yes, the chances of something happening that does bring the two major powers in direct confrontation to each other, both of them, you know, highly powered with nuclear weapons, the obvious danger is there. So much so that I was just hearing before we came on air discussion about a war game. I really do hate that word, but a war game being conducted during the Obama administration, where a scenario was sketched out in theory then, you know, based on the premise, the game premise of Russia invading a Baltic country and getting bogged down, as has happened here in Ukraine. And the scenario there foresaw, yes, a resort to tactical battlefield, what are so-called low-yield nuclear weapons, was a choice made in that scenario, at least, a theoretical scenario by the Russians. So the Pentagon clearly are well aware of that danger and, in fact, have sketched it out. But what do we do if that happens? What does the United States do? That actually wasn't sketched out in that war game. Nobody had the nerve or no desire to, as they say, go there. And now, as we look at it, we have to at least consider the possibility of some terrible sparking event that could lead to a much greater and much more appalling explosion. I mean, it's a almost inadequate word to use, because what we'd see, perhaps it might be the sight of a mushroom cloud that brings everyone to their senses. That was one of the ideas that was tossed around in the White House back in the Obama years. Or it could be worse than that. It could be, you know, the retaliation in kind is the only response that's capable of being made. I see, like you sound, I see a very pessimistic range of options open to the participants here. And maybe we just have to put our hopes in the fact that Putin will feel that he must quit and get out before it gets much, much worse for them because of the non-military measures taken against Russia in this isolated position that they find themselves now. Economically isolated, that's getting more serious for them. Maybe it's conceivable and that he's prepared to, you know, call a halt at some point because it's just getting too damned awkward for him. On the domestic front, you know, that may be what lies behind the proposals he evidently gave to the Turkish president Erdogan this week, which suggests a slight, I don't want to be sound pie in the sky here, but a slight preparedness to ratchet back a little bit from his maximalist demands that he's been making as his so-called in our terminology war aims. He won't even call it a war, of course. He calls it a limited military operation. But he's, you know, he's suggesting that a promise from Ukraine not to ever want to join NATO, that's one of his main fears, and a preparedness to have their eastern provinces go independent and be recognized as such as independent sectors, entities, that might be the beginning of a ceasefire agreement and maybe a lasting peace. But as I say, maybe this is too pie in the sky, but it bears out the idea that he's got other things on his mind other than getting a military victory in the field, and maybe the situation on the economic side of Russian life is going to be what makes him turn towards the negotiating table.
All right, David, always great to speak with you, and we'll see what happens in the course of the next week, and we'll speak to you next Friday.
Absolutely.
David Terechuk with The Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. And of course, once again, David has his own website, themediabeat.us is where you can find David's website. And also, you can find him at our website, robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand, click on The Media Beat with David Terechuk.